time once again for Community Forum, and we're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Steve Keen. Steve Keen is professor of economics and finance at the University of Western Sydney in Australia. In 2010, he won the Revere Award from the Real World Economics Review for being the economist who most cogently warned that the economic crisis that began in 2007 was imminent. He is a staunch critic of mainstream economic thinking and author of the book Debunking Economics, The Naked Emperor Dethroned, and the influential blog DebtDeflation.com. Steve, thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Welcome. Yeah. Though, actually, my little adjunct there, I'm no longer a professor at University of Western Sydney. They shut my economics department down, so I now call myself the world's most famous unemployed economist.
Was that due to budget cuts?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, there's other elements to it, but there's austerity is the theme around the world, of course, and market deregulation. So the government decided to deregulate how the universities advertise places, and it caused a temporary slump in our numbers, and our managers decided that was a good enough reason to shut down the economics degree.
All right. So tell us, how did you get involved with economics and finance?
Yeah, it goes back a long way. I mean, I'd have to go back really to my school days and say that I was a physics junkie and desperately wanted to become a physicist, and then I had 6 years of pretty hopeless science teachers and maths teachers at my school, and that actually browned me off physics, which is a great pity in some ways. And one brilliant economics teacher in year 11, which is the second last year before graduating high school in Australia, whose name was Tim Keating, with no relation to the guy who became our treasurer and prime minister at one stage, but gave me a brilliant vision of economics as a dynamic process. I'm talking about, as it happened, the most influential thing was Rostow's theory of economic growth, which is a cyclical theory of growth. And that got me addicted to economics. I managed to survive one more year of not particularly good teaching after he left, and then I got to university a complete believer in the conventional vision of supply and demand and equilibrium this and equilibrium that, and anti-trade unions, anti-monopoly, which tends to be part of the basis of economics. And in the beginning of first year, my lecturer pointed out a little theory which you're not supposed to learn till later days in economics called the theory of the second best, which put a complete hole through the conclusions that were, you know, anti-union, anti-monopoly arguments, and it inverted the arguments you get about, you know, you should deregulate everything. As soon as it said you had like a monopoly, then you should also have trade unions to balance the bargaining power. And that was a stunning result to me, and I thought, if it's that easy to overturn what looked like a straightforward conclusion of the theory, there's got to be something wrong with the theory. And that's when I dived in and started to become a critic and ultimately led a student rebellion at my university when I was an undergraduate student.
All right. And what was your motivation in writing your book, Debunking Economics?
Well, that's really because having developed over time, read the literature that I wasn't taught as an undergraduate, and because learning this particular flaw, which was called the theory of the second best, I then went looking through the academic literature, reading the journals themselves rather than reading the textbooks, and found there's an entire debate, for example, over one issue, which was how do you define capital, how do you measure capital, and it was actually a battle in whether you can talk about an aggregate thing we might call capital, the machinery, in working out what income distribution should be. So again, the argument conventional economics will make is that workers receive what they deserve and capitalists receive what they deserve, and they both deserve what's called their marginal product. And that sort of says that you can measure every extra worker who comes to work at your radio station produces a bit less output than the one beforehand, and you all end up receiving the wage of the very last person you decide to employ. And that's where you're receiving your marginal product. And the same thing is supposed to apply to capital, but it's easy enough to measure output of laborers, workers, in terms of the number of hours they put in. Yeah. But how do you, because you can then add up all the hours that you do and somebody else does in the radio station, and you can say X hours of work by the staff at the station. But when you try to do the same thing with machinery, how do you add a Dell monitor to a Sennheiser microphone and a, you know, EMF surge suppressor, et cetera, et cetera? You can't do it except by adding up the money amounts. If you add up the money amounts, and you're trying to say the money amounts determine the amount of money they get back, you've got the circularity that doesn't make any sense. And this huge debate occurred in the literature between the University of Cambridge, predominantly in England as the critics, and Massachusetts, the University in Cambridge in Massachusetts, known as the Cambridge Controversies. And this whole thing completely escaped the education of students. And when you looked at it, it was the critics who won. And even Paul Samuelson, who was on the defending the conventional theory, he ended up effectively conceding defeat. Now, you look at the textbooks, not a skerrick of that turned up in the textbooks. And the whole range of other critiques like that that I found as I continued reading. And by the time I got to being, you know, in my, around 2000, I'd developed a huge litany of all these issues of theoretical, soundly based theoretical critiques of economics that hadn't been transmitted into the textbooks at all. In fact, they'd been ignored. And I thought, this is just reprehensible. It's mendacious, not education, it's mendacity. And people then get snowed by economists saying, you just don't understand, this is, you know, why wages are what they are, et cetera, et cetera. And I knew that was garbage myself. And I thought, well, I can write a book which is a guide to why you shouldn't take economics seriously. And that's when I came up with Debunking Economics. And it was largely intended to bring together all the critiques that I was aware of. And I also wrote a couple of my own in the process of writing the book. And from that stage on, my voices got louder.
So talk a bit about Hyman Minsky and how he influenced your work.
Yeah. Minsky was someone that was one of those lucky pieces of serendipity. I had a great lecturer back when I did my master's when I went back to university. I didn't actually go straight from undergrad to a PhD, which is the standard course I approach most academics to. I meandered through school teaching, overseas aid, journalism, computer programming, computer journalism, radio journalism, and finally realized that what I thought should be doing in economics wasn't happening. I went back to university to do a master's. I hadn't done an honors degree, just completed the PhD. And I got given the task of writing a review of a book in a macro course in math, and one of the books was Hyman Minsky's John Maynard Keynes, which sounds like a biography. In fact, it's not. He called that really as a tribute to Keynes. It was really his vision of what he called the financial instability hypothesis. And I'd read, as well as reading critiques of conventional theory, I'd seen people trying to build an alternative, and everything I'd read before Minsky didn't come together in some way. Like there's people like Brann and Sweezy, who wrote Monopoly Capital, which was based on, you know, has a lot of sound ideas, but based on a Marxian concept called labor theory of value that I thought was nonsense. Other critiques talked about capitalism having a tendency towards underconsumption, which I didn't think was realistic. And then I read Minsky, and I thought, this guy's brought it all together, based largely on the work of Schumpeter, Fisher, and Keynes. And his vision was that capitalism is fundamentally unstable in an upwards direction. And if I can summarize, he has one brilliant phrase saying, stability is destabilizing. A capitalist economy is inherently unstable, and if you have a period of tranquility, what it tends to do is lead to people having rising expectations. The longer the tranquility goes on, the more they forget the most recent crisis, and therefore their expectations about the future rise, and they're more likely to borrow money and gamble and speculate on asset prices and risky projects and so on. He said the fundamental instability of capitalism is upwards, and it then causes people to take on excessive debt, but of course their expectations are what he called euphoric, not rational, but euphoric. They take on excessive debt, the projects don't all work. Then you get a crisis coming at the other end when there's failures of projects or the boom in asset prices collapses, and you have a cyclical tendency to accumulate debt over time, which can lead to a final economic crisis. And that's he only had a verbal model of that, and I thought it was a brilliantly complete verbal model, but he hadn't put it into a mathematical form, so I set myself the task in my PhD of making a mathematical model of that hypothesis.
So instability is a good thing, then?
That's a good question, because normally the way that neoclassical economics talk about the economy, instability is bad. You know, equilibrium is the wonderful state we all want to reach to. It's the nirvana of economic theory. And Minsky's PhD supervisor was a guy called Joseph Schumpeter. And Schumpeter comes from the Austrian perspective in economics. He's not an Austrian economist. He's Austrian, but the Austrians don't want to admit that he's Austrian. But his attitude was instability is part of the creative force of capitalism, and said that the fact that there is instability leads to innovation as well, which is something that often the Austrians group in economics, which is there's several different sects in economics. So the neoclassicals are the dominant ones. That's with Paul Krugman at one extreme and John Cochrane at the other. Austrians are a protest group, but they share the same philosophy as the neoclassicals in many ways. And the group I come from is called post-Keynesian. Schumpeter was the leader, the developer of what we call evolutionary economics. And he saw instability as being a bit like the fact that we're never perfectly evolved towards the environment. And we actually affect the environment, so therefore there's going to be a process of change and evolution in species. And he said exactly the same concepts apply in an economy. So you'll never have a perfect fit to anything. You will not have optimal anything. And therefore there's been an opportunity to evolve and change, but the evolution and change will then change the environment itself. And you get this positive feedback between niches never being perfectly filled, opportunities being available, firms come in to try to exploit the opportunity, therefore change the macro environment in the process of doing it. And instability is creative. Probably the best modern statement of that is actually by a guy called Bill Janeway, the very successful venture capitalist who did his PhD at Cambridge and then went out into the commercial world and was very influential in developing a lot of the computer technology we take for granted these days. And Bill's just published a book on, I've forgotten its title, I can't drag it out of the back of my brain, but his book is about the creative instability of capitalism. And that foundation, again, is where I come from. So a certain degree of instability is part of the creative force of capitalism, but you don't want instability leading to excessive accumulation of debt and breakdown. And that's what Minsky added to Schumpeter's vision, was that as well as this instability leading to innovation and new products being developed and a creative destruction, creative instability, you also get the tendency for the financial sector to want to create as much debt as they can, because by creating debt they create profit for themselves. And riding on top of this instability, you can accumulate so much debt that you can't pay that debt and capitalism collapses, not just individuals going bankrupt, but the whole system going bankrupt. So it's that instability you want to prevent. Cyclical behavior, creative instability, not a problem. It's the financial sector sitting on top of that, leading to an accumulation of debt that can cause a crisis. That's what Minsky's concern was, and that's what I'm now campaigning about, of course.
So do you see capitalism as a good thing?
Yeah, it's capitalism is, there's a lot of, one of the dangers of people working in economics and politics in general is they try to say, I can design a better system than X. Yeah. And again, having an evolutionary background, I say, well, X is what we've got. And when people try to devise a better system, you end up with catastrophes, unintended consequences coming out of those redesigns. So the whole idea of building socialism, for example, had a vision that capitalism was going to collapse under its own incapacity to produce a profit over time, from the theory that gave justification for the Soviet Union. And you got a police state out of it. Now, the capitalism again gets to huge accumulations of wealth and power. You get the Donald Trumps and the Murdochs and so on, and ultra rich in that sense. But you also get the opportunity for their wealth to be challenged by people innovating despite the power of monopolies against them. So if I went back 40 years' time, for example, on your radio show and said, we had to, the major corporation in computing is going to be a company called Microsoft, people would have been breaking up in cackles of laughter about this by a bunch of 13 pimply-faced twits down the road. Yeah, you're joking. They're never going to be able to compete with the likes of IBM. Well, they did. And that is a creative force in capitalism, which in many ways takes advantage of the tendency humans have to want to innovate. We are a species which innovates. That's one of the distinctive things about us compared to other species. Spiders spin webs, we spin yarns, and we spin new technologies. And capitalism enhances that, exploits it. But the trouble is, as well, as what some of my capitalist friends have said on various occasions, they try to privatize their profits and socialize their losses. And that's the real dilemma with capitalism, because it works when you've got an infinite horizon to exploit. But when you get to the stage where the waste we generate in producing the output on the economy becomes a challenge to the ecology, then that side of capitalism where it tries to socialize its losses, I'm sorry, that destroys the planet as well. So I am I'm a proponent of capitalism as a social system now. I'd certainly like to see lots of capitalist innovation on the front of how do we cope with ecological damage, but capitalism itself is a way of causing that. Now, equally, socialism did as well. Enormous waste and damage was done to the environment in Russia, so I'm not singling capitalism out for special attention there. But I think we're going to find ourselves having to evolve a different form of society to constrain the waste and damage we do over time in capitalism. It itself will have to evolve.
Some would say we're heading towards a police state now, at least in this country. I'm not sure how much you follow on that, but our civil liberties are shrinking as each day goes by.
Yeah, I mean, it's America's got some weird twist to it. Seeing America just as a capitalist nation, I think, forgets a whole lot of other trends that exist. I mean, you've got your radio station, in many ways, is part of the communitarian philosophy that's a large part of the American spirit. And you've got this ridiculous military orientation you've always had. And that it isn't just the capitalist side that gives you the sort of conflict we're talking about here. That militaristic background, the security paranoia that America has, and also the vision it has that when it invades the rest of the world, it's actually liberating it. You're the only country that invades another country and says, we're here to free you. I'm sorry? Invading forces take over. So I think there's still a frontier mentality in America that ends up with a lot of that police state behavior. And it's ironic because, you know, you've also got the Constitution of Liberty and statements about freedom of speech and so on. The only thing is you have freedom of guns, but you don't seem to have freedom of speech. And that, again, that's the religious side of this country, which again is quite unusual. In my country, the dominant religion is agnosticism. I'm not joking. When you do a census and people say, what's your religion? One of the choices is tick the box, say agnostic, no religion. That's the dominant choice. So America's strong focus on religion is something which is unusual. And so you certainly are suffering incursions on civil liberties here. I wouldn't say it's just the capitalist side of America that's to blame. It's that other weird mixtures in your culture as well that are part of it.
So talk about our current debt crisis, and is that the same thing as a deficit crisis?
No. Again, another good question. The real crisis of debt in capitalism is private debt. And that's what the reason I came out warning there's going to be a huge crisis was I was asked to do an expert witness case on a predatory lending situation where a family had been given 6 or 7 consecutive loans but through the same broker. Each loan, they failed to service each loan, they got another loan and so on, until such time as the gap between what they were owed on these loans, which had gone from $100,000 to, I think, $265,000 in a matter of 18 months, left very little residual value in the house, so they went after the house instead. And my case was to try to get the judge to be willing to write off at least the last loan contract. And the only way you can really do that, convince a judge to agree to break a contract, is to point out the contract has negative influences on third parties. So they approached me because they knew I was focusing. This is the Civil Liberties Group in Australia, approached me to be the expert on the case. And my case was that rising levels of debt in individual cases with lending should never have been allowed to happen, as in this particular case, do happen. It then affects other people because when the house gets sold, you know, you reduce house values elsewhere. People who are responsibly paying their mortgages find that their property values have fallen. So there are negative consequences to allowing that much debt to occur. And I wrote this throwaway line saying that debt to GDP or debt to income ratios have been rising exponentially. And I knew that as the expert rather than the barrister, I couldn't rely upon hyperbole, so that I better go and check it and I'll look at the data and it won't quite be exponential. I knew it had been risen over time, but won't be exponential, so I'll need to think of some other word. And then I plotted the Australian data ratio of private debt to GDP, and it fitted a perfect exponential curve from 1964 to 2005 when I wrote the statement. A couple of super exponential bubbles in the middle of it, but this perfect exponential fit. The R squared, for those who know such things, was 0.9912. You don't get much closer to perfect than that. And I just went, holy hell, no need to move the word exponential out of here. And this has got to burst. You can't continue having the ratio of debt to GDP rising exponentially. At some point, it's got to break. And when it does, it's going to be a huge crisis. The biggest in the data stream that I was looking at, which went back 40 years at that stage, And about 2 o'clock in the morning, this is when I first got the data out, and I thought I better check the American data, see what that looks like. And that gave me data back to 1952, and from 52 to 2005, not as closely fitting exponential, but the same sort of pattern. And I thought, this has got to be the biggest crisis when it bursts since 1952, probably the biggest since the Great Depression, well, biggest, obviously the biggest since the Great Depression. Somebody has to raise the alarm, I'm probably the somebody. So the focus, the argument I've ultimately developed is that, and this overturns not just the straight neoclassical idea of macroeconomics, but even my own school of thought, and I'm still having to convince my own colleagues on this front, that demand in a capitalist economy is not just income. You'll hear people, economists saying all the time, your spending is somebody else's income. That's completely true. But they think your spending is just your income as well. So they get this little circle, you know, one person's spending, another person's income, and they say aggregate demand or aggregate spending is aggregate income. We live in a credit-based economy. When you go borrow money from a bank, the bank doesn't hand me money in somebody else's deposit. They whack a loan on one side of the asset, the asset side of their ledger, and an extra liability on mine. I get extra spending power without reducing anybody else's spending power. So that one person's spending is their income plus their change in debt. And because of this expansion of spending power by the banking sector, aggregate demand is not just income. It's income plus the change in debt. Now, I get accused of double counting by neoclassical economists and by some of my fellows in post-Keynesian economics. I've now got a reasonable group that now agree with me that we're trying to push this idea forward, myself, Michael Hudson, Richard Werner, Dirk Bessemer, a few others. What that means is that the change in debt is a major driving factor in the level of demand in the economy. And what we had in America from 1993, when you got out the last recession, through to 2009, was the change in debt each year was getting bigger and bigger and bigger, level of private debt growing. So to give you an idea, in about 2000, the American GDP was about above the order of $10, $11 trillion, and the increase in debt that year with private debt was $2 trillion. We come forward when the crisis finally hit, the GDP was about $14 trillion, and the increase in private debt that year was another $4 trillion. So the total amount of money spent at the economy wasn't just $14 trillion in GDP, was $18 trillion. And, of course, that was spent not just buying goods and services, but also buying houses, buying shares, you know, all the asset speculation we do with borrowed money. Then when the crisis hit, that rate of growth turned totally around, and you went from debt growing by $4 trillion in 2008 over the year to dropping by $3 trillion in 2010. And that meant you went from being an $18 trillion economy to an $11 trillion economy. And that's why this huge severe crisis occurred. So you had a debt finance boom. The whole subprime bubble was debt finance driven, and then a debt driven collapse as well. And that's what caused the bubble before the crisis. It caused the crash as well. So the level of private debt is the issue, not public debt. And public debt rose in response to the collapse in private debt finance spending, because suddenly you weren't employing as many people. You therefore had lower income coming in. You had higher welfare payments going out. That's a major reason why the government deficit rose. So the government deficit is a bit like an air conditioning system. When it gets hot outside, the air conditioning system comes on. And when it gets cold outside, the air conditioning goes to warm. And effectively, that's what happened with government spending. So if you look at the level of debt, look at private debt and public debt, everybody's obsessing about public debt approaching the level of GDP. Still isn't quite there. So you've got GDP, again, about $14, $15 trillion, public debt heading towards that level. Private debt peaked at $42 trillion. And it's now fallen to $38 trillion. It's just starting to grow once more. But that collapse in private debt is what caused the crisis. And it's exactly the same thing that caused the crisis back in the Great Depression. So you're now carrying this huge overburden of private debt, which is roughly 250% of GDP. And that overburden of debt is going to be with you for decades if you don't reduce it in some deliberate fashion. And that's what causes the tendency to fall back into a collapse once more, because a certain amount of debt finance spending is necessary in a capitalist economy. If you look at corporations, they finance themselves they invest out of retained earnings, but they also invest out of borrowed money when the amount of investment they wish to do exceeds their retained earnings. And that doesn't mean the debt ratio has to rise over time. You can have a constant debt ratio coming out of that compared to GDP. And therefore, you have a higher level of investment than if you just invested using retained earnings. Now, when you had a crisis like we're in now, the best you're going to get is firms investing retained earnings, and therefore your economy is growing more slowly. And that's why you're in this permanent slump. Now, the obsession with getting the public debt down is a bit like saying, we've got this huge open gash on the body and this huge Band-Aid. The Band-Aid's ugly. Let's remove the Band-Aid. It's very bad thinking.
So if you just address the change in debt and perhaps like what they do with the Islamic banking system and not charging interest, would that solve the problem?
Oh, there's also ways you could try to reform the actual financial system and stop the accumulation of debt. And the real problem we've had is that we've exalted the financial sector, particularly in America, to being almost a godlike status, and we can't let the financial sector fail, blah, blah, blah. You've let it get too big, and the financial sector takes risks that are far beyond the risks that they should take. They finance, flip that house speculation, share market speculation, et cetera, et cetera. They really should be providing finance for industrial capitalism and for necessary consumption by households, and not much more than that. And one of the good arguments about how to stop them going beyond that would be to remove the protection they get from limited liability that applies to normal corporations. But normal corporations have got physical limits on what they can produce and the profits they can make. Whereas financial corporations, because they create money by double entry bookkeeping, just by simply asset of a loan here and a liability of a deposit over there, they can get away with an enormous increase in debt. They don't have production costs constraining them. And if you go back in history, banks weren't given limited liability. It's only in the recent history, past the last century or so, we've done that. And if you wanted to stop the banks doing that, being much more judicious about what they do and don't invest or finance, then bringing back unlimited liability for bankers might do it.
So just under 3 minutes left. So what do you see as a potential solution towards our current crisis?
Yeah, you've got to reduce the level of private debt and rapidly, because you're basically being burdened by a private debt load of, as is now, 250% of GDP, when a sensible load for American economy is of the order of 60 to 70% of GDP. And if you reduce it by people paying their debt down by going bankrupt or slowly spending less than they earn and paying their income down, you'll be facing a 20-year slump like Japan's been in. So what I'd prefer to do is say, let's have a modern debt jubilee. In the past, debt jubilees were a common part in old societies. We thought we're too advanced and too modern for those. Garbage. We've got the biggest debt bubble ever in human history right now. So we have to reduce the debt, and a debt jubilee would do it. But the banks have made it doubly hard, because as well as producing too much debt, they've sold that debt to people as AAA assets. And people who think they were saving have bought assets off the banks, and those savers would be disadvantaged by a debt jubilee. So my suggestion is to use a particular power the Federal Reserve has, which is Section 13.3 of the Federal Reserve Act, lets them inject money directly into the bank accounts of individuals and companies, and use that money, that capacity to create money into the economy in a way that QE does not do, put that money in people's bank accounts, and with the condition that if they're in debt, they must pay the debt down. But if they're not in debt, they get a cash bonus, and then use that to rebalance the economy, to have more fiat-based money, less credit-based money, reduce the size of the financial sector, reduce the level of debt in the economy by that action, and do it in such a way that debtors now have more capacity to spend and savers don't lose spending capacity because of the cash injection, and then reverse the mistake of letting the financial system, the private credit system, create too much debt. It sounds like a mistake. Yes, it'd be wrong in isolation, but as we're saying with Alan before getting here, we've made an enormous error, and there's no painless way out of it. The least painful way, I think, would be a debt jubilee.
And it sounds a lot better giving the money to the people than it is to the banks, who then will perhaps give some of it back to the people.
Yeah, this is the thing. People talk about QE as printing money. It ain't. Printing money, we won't be whacking little money in brown envelopes and putting it in the mail to everybody. It doesn't get to Main Street. The only way that money can get into the system is actually through Wall Street and the banks actually buying shares off the public. So I think there's a real argument that QE is inflated asset prices. But it's trivial compared to the amount of money in QE. It's not getting to the public. We need to get it to the public to reduce the level of private debt.
All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
It was a great interview. Thank you very much.